Let us pray. Our Father and our God, who has called us into thy service and guided us to this hour, we pray that thou wilt make us worthy of our calling. Be with those who carry heavy responsibility in church and state, including those who take counsel for the welfare of the world. May thy love restrain us from evil and constrain us to overcome evil with good in ourselves and in our common life. Enable us on this campus today to devote our intelligence and energy to the tasks which thou hast set for us. And in all that we do, keep us mindful of thy goodness and of the needs of our neighbors throughout the world. Amen. President Binkley, colleagues of the faculty, fellow students, and distinguished guests, in 1967, Mr. and Mrs. Robert A. Culler, lay leaders in the First Baptist Church of High Point, North Carolina, made a contribution to the endowment fund of Southeastern Baptist Theological Seminary with the stipulation that there should be given each year at the spring convocation an award to be called the Midler Theology Award in recognition of distinguished work of a Midler student in the course in systematic theology. The criteria for evaluation include the student's overall performance in the course in systematic theology and the submission of a paper judged by three professors in the theological area. I have the happy privilege this morning of making this award, and I should like to ask Mr. Jack Clifford to come to the platform. Clifford. It was the desire and the instruction of the donors of this award that the student would select, in consultation with professors in theology, books which would be useful in the further study of theology, and that these books are to be presented in this service. Mr. Clifford has selected volumes of Karl Barth's Church Dogmatics, and I'm happy to present these to him at this time. Congratulations. Colleagues and I welcome you to this convocation. We should like to express a very cordial welcome to guests from out of the community And to those who have entered this school for the first time at the beginning of this semester, the resources of this institution are available to you, and our minds and our hearts are always open to you. Dr. H. Max Smith will present the convocation lecture. Dr. Smith is a graduate of the University of Missouri and the University of Oklahoma and earned the Doctor of Sacred Music degree at Union Theological Seminary in New York City. He came to this school in 1959 as artist in residence, and in 1965 was elected to the faculty as associate professor of music. Last year, he was on sabbatical leave for research in New York City and in Europe. He has exceptional skill and achievement as an organist, composer, and teacher. He understands the role of music in worship and is an excellent interpreter of the major motifs of the Christian faith. I have the honor to present Dr. Smith, who will speak to us at this time on the separation of the church and the arts. Dr. Smith.
Thank you very much, Dr. Binkley, and I'm delighted to speak to you this morning. The title of this lecture, The Separation of the Church and the Arts, is not intended to imply a proposed course of action, but it is intended to be a judgmental statement about a reality at this time in history. It will be our purpose to examine briefly the historical alliances of the arts and the church and to indicate certain points of schism in order to discover where the exacerbation may have come. After presenting a few reasons why the church and the arts should be reunited, I will propose some positive suggestions which might implement the beginnings of a union. For the purpose of this lecture, I will speak of the arts in a general sense, but essentially I will limit the term to mean the creative products of serious sculptors, painters, architects, choreographers, and composers of music. When we reflect upon the history of the church, we see an institution which is not consistent in its theology of the arts. There are times when the church is very suspicious of the arts, times when ecclesiastical mandates forbid the use of the arts. During some period, the church has looked upon the arts as being merely producers of sensuous feelings, totally inappropriate to the church's worship. St. Augustine confesses that he has allowed a beautiful melody to distract his devotional exercises. But early in the history of the church came to recognize the power of the arts. The question remained for some time whether this power were for good or for evil. On the one hand, by excluding works of art from the church, there would be no possibility of corruption. On the other hand, by excluding the arts from the church, a great spiritual power might be lost. Obviously, if the arts were to be welcomed into the church must take a risk. It was precisely during the times when the church was willing to take this risk that the great masterpieces of religious art were produced. And it was at these points when the church was nurtured most by the creative artistic products. Now, the question confronting the contemporary church is much the same. Should the church risk embracing contemporary art. We have only to glance at the history of art and the history of the church to recognize high peaks of collaboration. The icon of the Greek Orthodox Church is an example of great art nourishing spiritual devotion and serving the church's theology. A Michelangelo could produce great masterpieces only with the aid of the church and its teachings. Michelangelo and the church served each other's needs. Gothic architecture was a method of construction, but it also pointed to principles in the theology of worship. The church produced the theology and the functional needs which brought Gothic structure into being, and the architects responded by producing an art which served the church well. Perhaps the greatest composer of music in the history of Western civilization is Johann Sebastian Bach. During most of his life, Bach served the Protestant church, dedicating his craft of musical composition to the glory of God. Bach brought to the worshipers of his day a dimension of biblical exegesis which has not been surpassed. When the church kindled the flame of Christianity in the spirit of artistic creators, when the church voiced a need for artistic works, when the church welcomed the artistic creations which had been produced by the artists, and when the church gave the artists freedom to express the Christian message in their own peculiar way and through their individual medium, then great masterpieces were produced. The church which nurtured the God-given talent of man reaped a hundredfold reward by having at its disposal works of art which could in turn nurture a dimension of the Christian faith unattainable in any other way. Now, a second glance into the history of the arts and the church reveals another important lesson. The great peaks of spiritual and artistic alliance have arisen during eras in which the products of creative artists have been in a contemporaneous style. Each period in the history of art has been governed by unique stylistic traits. For example, a common attitude toward the method of structure was held by all artists who worked during the Baroque era. Each artist handled this general stylistic manner in his own individual way. But these common stylistic traits prevailed because it was thought that this particular approach would best speak to the people who lived at that time. Now review Beethoven's Ninth Symphony as a great work of art which still has meaning to 20th century man. One of the many reasons it is a great work of art is that its message is universal and timeless, and that it is capable of infinite elucidation. However, this does not alter the fact that the work was created for a particular cultural era, and that it probably had its greatest impact on the Viennese community in the early 19th century. Beethoven could not have composed creatively in the style of Bach. Bach could not have served the church had he been forced to compose in the style of Palestrina. Today, Stravinsky or Penderecki cannot serve the church if the church demands that they compose in the style of Brahms. It is foreign to their entire method of creative expression. Any composer working in 1969 must express himself in the contemporary style if he is to produce a work of art. To compose music in a 19th century style today can only produce a synthetic imitation which has no meaning, and which cannot really last as a work of art. It can be used only as a temporary and inferior tool. We can rejoice at those periods in history when the church and the arts were united in a common cause. However, there were other times when the church was not willing to risk the use of the arts for religious purposes. There was always the fear of idolatry. When suspicions arose, the arts were attacked with vehemence. One such instance took place during the Protestant Reformation. Both Calvin and Zwingli were at least temporarily successful in purging the church of artistic expression. Sculptures were dragged from the churches and broken. Paintings removed and burned. Choirs were abolished. Pipe organs were ripped out and their pipes melted. Zwingli defined a pipe organ as a papistical box of whistles used for the illusion of souls. This war on the arts was, in one sense, a part of the attack on the Roman Catholic Church. Because the Romans made use of the arts, the protesting church wanted no part of them. The logic was not altogether clear. Therefore, the leaders of this Reformed church developed a theology of worship which specifically excluded the arts. Under the general umbrella of simplicity, there was a rigorous attempt to remove material symbolism from worship. Obviously, these leaders failed to recognize the possible religious power which is inherent in the arts, and instead of providing a stimulus for a new direction in artistic expression, they destroyed religious artistic creativity for a time. Luther, instead of rejecting the arts, provided the very avenue through which artistic expression flowed for 200 years. Since Luther understood that, in part, the spiritual is mediated through the material, he gave impetus for fostering a new direction for the arts, especially the art of music. Roman Catholic worship had stressed a contemplative piety, and as such, it found particularly useful the arts of painting and sculpture. On the other hand, Luther envisioned more activity in the church's worship. Music being an art which action takes place in time became the preferred medium. This medium was so successful that it became a crowning achievement in the history of the arts and culminated in the musical compositions of J.S. Bach. Now, another ingenious idea which Luther had was to activate the congregation by the use of indigenous folk materials. These were materials which sprang from the people themselves and became a chief vehicle for self-expression in worship. These expressions were not considered works of art. The artists recognized the validity of such an endeavor and saw no conflict with their role as artists. In fact, they frequently used these folk elements in their artistic works. Luther's concept of wedding the arts and the church was not to last. Pietism became more forceful and could not see the need for artistic, or as they called, decorative music in worship. Church leaders began to speak harshly of the cantata and other forms of artistic expression. Even Bach himself had to turn to theoretical composition in his last years. By the time of Bach's death, in 1750, the institutional church had restricted itself in such a way that the arts had no entree. The church decided that the products of artistic creativity were not useful to the institution. Since 1750, the mainstream of genuine artistic creativity has taken place outside the church. This is still true today. Now, there is need in any society for art. When the church rejected the arts, the artist and his creativity, it was necessary for them to look elsewhere for expression. Opera houses, museums, concert halls were all built so that man could satisfy his need for participation in art forms outside the church. The artists fled to a secular society and eventually separated themselves from the church with a philosophy of art for art's sake. The religious substance found in great works of art still exists to a certain extent, but it exists outside the church. Now, this is where we are today. Great masterpieces of artistic creativity are created outside the church and for a secular society. Many people are beginning to search for some meaning in life by examining great contemporary works of art. Statistics indicate that more Americans attend symphony concerts of serious music than attend all sports events. Museums are so crowded that they must remain open during the evening hours and on Sundays, their busiest day of the week. This revitalized interest in the arts has just begun to touch Southern culture, but undoubtedly it will permeate this section of the country in the years ahead. With respect to the arts, where is the church? Seemingly, the church is separated from the world of the arts without being fully conscious of this separation. The people of the church have been led to believe that the church makes use of the arts. After all, we have a building. Is this not architecture? We play the organ in church. Is this not music? We give our children pictures. Is this not painting? We have a choir which sings an anthem each Sunday. Is this not an artistic expression? All of these questions are indicative of how the church views the arts today. When the artists answer the question, "Is this not art?" with a resounding no, the church is offended and retreats into its sphere of religious exclusiveness. Most artists would say to the church that these attempts at art are invalid because the usual trite expressions employed by the church are not worthy to be called art. One of the difficulties, of course, arises in semantics, that is, what is art? And this question has stimulated the best of thinkers for hundreds of years. It is not my purpose to offer an original answer here. I am interested in pointing out that the church usually comes up with the wrong answer. The church views art as a tool which can be manipulated and used for a defined purpose. In many instances, the church says, "We will use organ music in worship only if it is the kind of music which will merely bathe the worshiper in sound, provide a retreat whereby the worshiper may forget the cares of the world, exude a sensuous feeling of religiosity, or through association call forth wells of sentimentality." Unfortunately, this kind of art does not say anything. The artist would say, "This is not art." As long as the choir's anthem on Sunday morning has a religious text, the music is regarded as sacred, whether it is or not. Churches continue to build edifices which artistic architects call structural lies. The world of the arts simply dismisses these examples as being no art at all. You see, what the church does is to take the materials from which artistic creations are made to dictate a religious or educational function for these materials to perform, and then to anoint the result as art. This illusion of art can be propagated as long as congregations do not discover the primary reality of art. When they do, the materials of art generally used in our churches will no longer provide any kind of religious feeling. It will be viewed only with disgust. The idea that the materials of art should be used for manipulative purposes is shared by advertising agencies, the entertainment world, and much of the church. The genuine artist will have no traffic with this kind of philosophy. This misconception which prevails in the church concerning the arts has caused a second factor of separation to emerge. With very few exceptions, the church does not participate in the world of contemporary artistic creations. For instance, one rarely hears atonal music performed as a part of the church's worship. Yet, atonal music has been a primary method of musical composition for at least the last 50 years. A few contemporary churches have been built, but for the most part, they have been misunderstood. One would not expect most churches to have a cubist painting in the sanctuary, much less op art. The reason the church has not employed the contemporary arts is really quite obvious to the artist. The style used by contemporary artists cannot be prostituted or manipulated. Either one grasps the primary significance of a piece of contemporary art, or one has nothing to do with it. In contrast to earlier art styles, the contemporary arts cannot be used in a manner in which they were not intended to be used. If one does not grasp the artistic significance of form, balance, color, rhythm, and the like in Da Vinci's Mona Lisa, one can always view the work as a mere pictorial representation and say, doesn't she smile in a peculiar way? The pictorial representation has little to do with the Mona Lisa's being a great work of art, but this secondary interpretation can be used. If one does not grasp the symbolic import in listening to the architectural structure of the first movement of Schubert's Unfinished Symphony, one can always hum along with this perfectly lovely tune. This perfectly lovely tune is really only a structural element used to build a form which has artistic significance. But one cannot view a contemporary painting as mere pictorial representation because the work may have no picture. One cannot hum along with a pretty tune in contemporary music because very often a pretty melody is not present. The structurally significant form is present, or it is not a work of art, but new materials have been used in the structure. And these materials cannot be readily interpreted in a secondary way. Therefore, the church has little use for the creations of contemporary artists because it cannot impose a secondary interpretation on these arts. Contemporary artists insist by their creations that the primary significance of their works be comprehended. And they do not view the church as an institution which can use their creations on this level. To summarize the situation, the church was at least partially responsible for driving the artists from its doors. The artists retreated to secular patronage and developed a philosophy of art for art's sake. With this philosophical banner, a new style of artistic expression was developed in the 20th century, which had to be understood or totally rejected. Statistics will verify the fact that artists have not been totally rejected by contemporary society, but that their voices are being heard with greater frequency each year. For the last 200 years, the church has been out of contact with the mainstream of the arts. It has used primarily second-rate creations from the materials of art, and it has imposed a secondary interpretation on these creations. The people of the church have lived under a false illusion and have used the arts in a strictly secondary way. They have had no traffic with the arts whereby they might become aware of the revelatory qualities inherent in artistic creativity. Or they have learned of the arts outside the church and have come to view with disgust the misuse of the arts in the church. Therefore, the church finds itself in the embarrassing position of not being able to use the contemporary arts because most people of the congregation would be perplexed by the association. Now, I suppose the easier task would be just to end this lecture at this point. However, I feel compelled to offer some hope for a possible reuniting of the church and the arts. Allow me to mention briefly some points of contact which I feel need to be fostered. Number one, there needs to be a clearer exposition of how the arts communicate and a better understanding of what the arts have to say. This is a difficult task. The arts, in large measure, communicate through a symbolic language. And Susan Langer is probably correct in assuming that the symbol is unconsummated. At any rate, the aesthetic symbol is akin to the mental act of perception, and the perceiver sees or hears an organization of reality symbolizing and expressing itself. In recent years, theologians have begun to grapple with a theology of the arts, and there have been some notable results. Recent titles such as Theology in the Arts, Nature and Grace in Art, Christian Faith and the Contemporary Arts, demonstrate the fact that a serious attempt is being made by religious thinkers to understand the message of the arts. Unfortunately, creators of great works of art are of little help in articulating the meaning of their creations. A poem is a poem does not tell us much. The work of art means what it is about all that an artist can say. The artist is as perplexed as anyone else about how his creations come into being. He understands well the nature of the structure, and he knows intuitively when he has fashioned the correct materials into a proper order. However, he gives birth to a creation which he cannot explain in a rational, discursive language. He can only say to us, the work of art must speak for itself. Come and experience it. Artists generally tend to discount the probings of psychologists concerning artistic creation, but I think it is possible that psychologists may find some helpful bridge which will be useful for understanding the arts. Number two, the church and the arts must discover a common ground. The problem between the church and the arts is not that they are in mortal combat with one another, but that they ignore each other. I am suggesting that the church have dialogue with the arts. How does the artist view human feelings? How does the artist view ultimate reality? In what way does the artist understand the demonic? How does the artist understand love? The work of art and its perceiver relate to each other in a kind of interaction. The perceiver brings to the work of art the background of his entire being. A part of this being can be a religious being. For the Christian, the arts have a part to play in the understanding of incarnation. The contemporary arts are particularly articulate about a doctrine of man. The arts are capable of a revelation about the nature of God. Let us discover these common grounds between the arts and religion so that religious symbols will spring forth from artistic creations and so that the church will not be impoverished by the absence of an important dimension of religious understanding. Number three, the church and the arts must agree to serve each other with freedom and honesty. The church must not insist that artists create tools for religious propaganda. Artists must have the freedom to organize some aspect of reality as it is revealed to them. The artist must be honest with his own talent. The church should provide an incentive for the artist and allow the artist to respond in freedom. You see, artists have never totally rejected the possibility of a religious dimension to their creations, even though they may not articulate it. The church must risk the presence of the sacred in art and provide for its usefulness in worship. Now, some suggestions for the church may be in order. In our perplexing world, it is very difficult to attempt to chart a pragmatic course for the church, and it is certainly presumptuous of me to do so. However, allow me to offer some suggestions about how the church might go about incorporating the materials of art in its worship. In the first place, I think the church should return to Luther's idea about the use of indigenous materials of art, which can be used by the entire congregation in the form of spontaneous creative self-expression. Remaining with us is a remnant of this idea in the form of congregational hymn singing. This form of congregational expression has declined seriously in the past few years. Most congregations simply have no enthusiasm for singing. One reason for this is that our worship has become increasingly more of an entertainment production. Going to church is somewhat like watching television, except that the quality of entertainment is not nearly as good. A second reason is that the hymns which we offer the congregation are quite out of touch with the modern world. The texts are archaic, and most of the melodies are either dreary or cheap. A new kind of congregational song which would couple meaningful contemporary texts with a music which utilizes indigenous folk idioms should be developed. Other congregational self-expressions, such as spontaneous painting and modern dance, could be used to good advantage. Obviously, this will require a complete rethinking and a drastic restructuring of our worship. In order to deal with the generation gap, multiple opportunities for the celebration of worship should be offered. Incidentally, it is my hope that each of you can participate in the celebration being planned for the missions conference on our campus this year. In the second place, the church should discontinue the use of cheap imitations of art. Most of what is rendered in many churches each Sunday morning in the name of art does not deserve this title at all. Poor performances of worthless music can only detract from worship. It is the inartistic painting, not the genuine work of art, which has the threat of idolatry. The local church must realize its limitations concerning works of art and not attempt a compromise. Three, the church should offer in its program of Christian education a place for the religious appraisal of great works of art. Only then can the art serve the church at worship. People must be shown how a dimension of faith can be apparent in the arts. At present, the church uses only a program of music education, which is modeled after a public school concept of the 1920s. This entire concept needs rethinking. Finally, the church, in dialogue with the world of the arts, can encourage creativity of genuine art forms. When the church clearly states a need for great works of art, I believe the artists will respond. Most artists feel that they are out of touch with many people. They are eager to fulfill a need if they can do so in freedom and without compromising their integrity as artists. You see, the church and the arts really have much to give each other. Christianity can give birth to an incomparable passion. And this passion can become an inspirational wellspring of artistic creativity. Artists can give to the church the products of their creativity, which can in turn provide added dimensions to the understanding of the Christian faith.
Guide our minds, O God, in the search for truth and beauty. Give us courage to search honestly. Give us humility to search reverently. And as the search brings us closer to thyself and to one another, bring us to our knees in adoration and to our feet for creative work in the Spirit of Jesus Christ. Amen.